You see God's power in there, don't you? You see his power in the healing of the sick. You see his power in the raising of the dead. And our passage is laid out very similar to what we looked at last week with Saul and seeing him and his work in Damascus and then him and what God had for him in Jerusalem. This week we see, of course, Peter in Lydda and then Peter in Joppa. And the outline for each of those towns is the same. We'll describe the location, then the person in need, we'll see the miracle, and then the result or the response to the miracle. So let's start off looking again at verse 32, the location of Peter's work and God's power at work through Peter. Now, as Peter was traveling through all those regions, he came down also to the saints who lived at Lydda. Last time we hear from Peter is back in chapter 8, and we focused on other people, other work God is doing. Much has happened since we've heard about what's going on in his life. And Luke tells us that he's traveling through all those regions. And what regions are we talking about? Well, the verse right previous to this one speaks about the church and its growth in Judea, Galilee, and Samaria. So all the regions around Jerusalem, that's where Peter is traveling around and doing ministry. He comes to a place known as Lydda. Philip had been here before Peter had been here. In the Old Testament, this city or this town is known as Lod. And even today, it's known as Lod, L-O-D. This is the place today where Israel's International Airport sits just outside of the city. It's about a day's journey from Jerusalem in Peter's day, not today. And it's on the road down to Joppa. So there's where Peter is located. Now look at the person in need. We're told in verse 33 that there he, Peter, found a man named Aeneas who had been bedridden 8 years, for he was paralyzed. Aeneas, this is a Greek name. This man could have been a Hellenistic Jew. We've spoken about that specific group of people before. Some think he's a believer at the point where Peter meets him. Others, and I think this is more fair, see him as not a believer because of the way he's described. Peter found a man named Aeneas. He seems like a random man as far as Peter is concerned. And we're told that this man has a need. He has been bedridden 8 years, for he was paralyzed. 8 years. What's he been doing? Well, he's been lying in bed. He hasn't gotten out of bed for nearly a decade. You think about not our comfortable beds that we have today. You think about the pallets they carried around, and people slept on those. Pallets they carried around if they were going to be dropped off at a place where they might beg to receive what they needed for food and drink. This man has been pallet bound for this many years. Peter's in a similar situation as he had been earlier in Acts chapter 3, isn't he? You remember there where he's with John and they come across a man who says from his mother's womb hadn't been able to walk. And God uses Peter and John there to heal the man. This man is described as being paralyzed for these 8 years. He's suffering from palsy. He's weak. He's disabled either from a disease or an accident. His limbs just don't function, and we're not told if he is not able to move only his legs or he's not able to move his legs or his arms. He's just not able to function. It's a dark time for this man. Perfect opportunity for God to display his power. God seems to glory in working in ways that magnify his power. And those ways are most clear when you have a background that's dark, a background that's difficult. And for those of you, for those of us who've walked with the Lord for any number of years, you understand that to be true just in life. It's during the trials of life, the difficulties of life, that God shines through most powerfully, most strongly. You know, when you go to a jeweler and he wants to show you or she wants to show you a piece of jewelry, a ring or a necklace, they don't lay it just on some dirty counter. They lay it on black felt, don't they? So that you can see the brilliance of the stones, the beauty of the jewelry against that backdrop of black. It comes through most clearly. God is in the business of doing this. You might have heard of the hymn writer, Isaac Watts. He was a man who was very sickly in his life. And one person even describes him as frail and grotesque in appearance. He was less than 5 feet tall. He had a large head and a hooked nose, as he's described. But do you know what God did? He used this man to become the father of English hymnody. He wrote scores and scores and scores of hymns. Hymns like Jesus Shall Reign, O God, Our Help in Ages Past, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, Joy to the World. You're all familiar with that one. One hymn he wrote captures this idea of God's power, even as it's working in his own life. It's called I Sing the Mighty Power of God. Verse 1 says, I sing the mighty power of God that made the mountains rise, that spread the flowing seas abroad and built the lofty skies. I sing the wisdom that ordained the sun to rule the day. The moon shines full at his command, and all the stars obey. What a powerful and beautiful song about God's greatness. And it's even more powerful and more beautiful as you understand the author and his difficulties in life. So Aeneas is a person in need. Now, the miracle. Look at verse 34. Peter said to him, Aeneas, Jesus Christ heals you. Get up and make your bed. Let's stop right there. Jesus Christ is not physically present with Peter. That's clear, right? But Peter, because of his relationship with God, and because of how God has gifted him and the rest of the apostles, is able to say, Jesus Christ heals you. This is Peter's second opportunity that's been recorded for us of healing a paralyzed person. He just says the words, and the man is made whole. The man is made physically complete. He tells him, not only has he been healed, he tells him, get up and make your bed. He's so complete, he's so physically healed that he can get up and do activities now. He can get to work. Before this time, the previous 8 years, only other people could do what Peter is telling this man to do. And now he's telling this man to get up and work. You know what happens to a person when they're not able to move their limbs for any length of time. And when we say any length of time, you can just see a difference in a person if it's just been a week or 2 weeks or a month. Imagine the atrophy in this man's legs, maybe arms, after 8 years. You know, the muscles just waste away if they're not used. Even the bones begin to disintegrate and become brittle. And so when this man is healed, God's power is not just seen in the fact that his body was one way, but it just didn't function. And it was the same, but now it could function. It was his body was completely different. And God worked in that moment of time and changed all of his muscles and changed the bones so that they would be able to support his weight. And all of a sudden, in an instant, he's able to stand up and walk. We talk about God being more than perfect. And this is why. Because not only is God able to create perfectly, which he did in creation, not only is he able to sustain that creation perfectly, which he does every day, but he's able to take something that's broken and return it to a functioning position. He's able to take something imperfect and make it perfect. You know, he does that spiritually. I know it's hard for you to see as a follower of Jesus Christ because of life on earth. You stumble, you sin, you're tempted, and you look at yourself and you think, well, I'm nowhere near perfect, and that's true. We're nowhere near perfect. But when God changes you, when he saves you because of your faith in Jesus Christ, you're able to walk with Jesus Christ. And the hope is, as you think of eternity, you will be fully complete at that moment. And God will take you, a broken, fallen, sinful person, and one day you'll be perfect. You see, God is more than perfect because of his power. Well, look at the result now. The end of verse 34. We already looked at the fact that immediately he got up. So that's the result. Peter's only given him the command. The result is he gets up. And now verse 35. And all who lived at Lydda and Sharon saw him, and they turned to the Lord. So Lydda's the town right there. Sharon is not a town. It literally means the plain. And this plain extended from the area of Lydda and Joppa north about 50 miles. And it was there along the coast, about 10 miles wide. And you can imagine what's going on here. When Luke tells us that all who lived at Lydda and Sharon saw him, what do you think this man is doing? He's walking around. He's going through this 50-mile strip by 10-mile strip of land talking to people about what God has done for him. And people see him, and he's been somebody who's well known. This is the man who was paralyzed in bed for 8 years, and now he's walking around. So he's able to speak to people and tell people about what God has done for him. What an effective witness he must have been. And again, we understand the principle that the effectiveness of witness is determined by the strength of faith and the depth of trial. The greater faith you have, the better witness you will be. That makes sense. The greater trial you have, the greater witness you'll be. Look at the very end of verse 35. We see God's power here as well, don't we? And they turned to the Lord. There's conversion that's happening. So the result is not just Aeneas, and we're thankful for that result, that he can walk. But the result is conversion. There are other providences of God going on that are added into these people who are converted. They may have talked to others. They may have heard about Christianity. They may have done some reading in their own scripture. All the details of their lives are brought together according to God's perfect planning. And the gospel is now bearing fruit among a wider audience. And as you see this pattern, just in our few verses of the first part of our passage here this morning, you see the location, the person in need, the miracle, and the result. You've heard of the phrase rinse, wash, and repeat. This can be used for what goes on in the book of Acts. It's just a pattern that goes on over and over and over again. It's been happening since the beginning of the book, and it will happen all the way through the end of the book. We have a location given, then we have a person or persons in need. Sometimes it's an individual like Aeneas or Tabitha that we'll read about in just a moment. Sometimes it's an entire city like Thessalonica or Corinth. So the location, the people in need, a miracle, and then the result. Sometimes the miracles are visible, and sometimes they're spiritual and invisible. But we understand that perceptibility is not equal to magnitude. Perceptibility or visibility is not equal to magnitude. What are we saying? That as amazing as it is for a person to stand up and walk all of a sudden after being bedridden for 8 years, that's something you can see, and that is powerful. That's God's power at work, and that's marvelous. But our senses are not always able to appreciate the power of God. So that's powerful to us because we can see it. But there is nothing more powerful than a heart that is changed. It's a true statement. There is nothing harder in all of creation than the human heart. And when God changes a human heart, he is overcoming much more difficulty than having some guy stand up who's just been in bed for 8 years. You know what? He's even overcoming much more difficulty than we'll see in just a moment, where somebody is dead and he makes them alive physically. That is powerful. Nothing in comparison to changing a heart from being dark and headed for hell to being enlightened and following after Jesus Christ, heading to heaven. That is magnitude beyond comparison as we look at these events in the book of Acts. So that's Peter in Lydda. Now we move to Peter in Joppa. God continues to work through this man. Now in Joppa, and this was just down the road from Lydda. Here's the location. Now in Joppa, there was a disciple named Tabitha. Let's stop there. Let's talk about Joppa just for a moment. This city's mentioned all the way back in the book of Joshua, when they're dividing the land there in the promised land among the different tribes. That was around 1400 BC. So we're talking 3,400 years ago, this city was mentioned. Today, it's still there. It's known as Jaffa now, with F's instead of P's. This is in the southernmost part of the modern-day city, Tel Aviv. And Joppa, or Jaffa, is known as Jerusalem's port city. As you understand, Jerusalem has no connection to the ocean, to the Mediterranean. It's too far inland. So when anything was done in Jerusalem that was connected to the sea, Joppa was the city through which the activity would occur. For example, back in the days when the temple is being built, Solomon receives cedars of Lebanon, and they're put on a raft in the ocean, and the raft moves down the ocean, and they are gathered in Joppa and then brought up to Jerusalem. And you remember the story about Jonah, a prophet in Israel, and he decides he wants to flee from God and he wants to get on a boat and go as far away from Jerusalem as he can get. Where does he go? He goes to Joppa to get on the boat and depart. That's the location. Now, the person in need is described to us as Tabitha in verse 36, and her name is also Dorcas. Tabitha is Aramaic, a language which is linked to Hebrew. Dorcas is Greek. So many people in the New Testament have two names, don't they? You wonder how that happened, how that developed. It's probably the fact that they spoke different languages, and it was common to have a Greek name, a Hebrew name, and maybe some other elements are going on there. You have people like John Mark, and now we have Tabitha Dorcas, although we don't hear her called by those two names. You have Simon Peter, and he's even given described as Cephas as well. And then you have Saul, who becomes Paul. Sometimes they're known by their two names, John Mark. Sometimes they're not. We never hear of Saul or Paul being called Saul Paul or Paul Saul. We just hear the one name at a time. So here we look at this woman as being called one name at a time. We'll call her Tabitha as we move through our passage. Both words, Tabitha and Dorcas, if she moved to the States today and lived here, she would be known as Gazelle, because that's what the name means, Gazelle, in both languages. And the name Gazelle, the animal Gazelle, was a favorite among the Hebrews to describe beauty. In fact, you can read about this in Song of Solomon, chapters 2 and 4 and 7, the connection of beauty to Gazelle. Tabitha is likely single. She's the first woman who we are given the name of after Pentecost, except for Sapphira, Ananias' wife. And she was not a good example to follow. So here's the first woman who would be a positive example. And how is she described? The end of verse 36. This woman was abounding with deeds of kindness and charity, which she continually did. She described two ways. Deeds of kindness. These are small acts of goodness, small encouragements. today, a person who was involved with this kind of living would be somebody who liked to help other people to accomplish little tasks or get chores done or go on errands for people. Somebody who maybe spent time writing notes of encouragement or notes of sympathy to people. This would be a more informal kind of ministry that she just does ongoingly. It also says that she was abounding in charity. This seems to be a more formal kind of work that Tabitha did, helping those in need. And we think immediately of orphans and widows. In fact, widows come into the passage prominently as we move forward, and you'll see that in our reading. In general, those who worship God were involved with charity, because that's just the way that we express love for each other, love for brothers and sisters in Christ who are in need. And that is also how we express love for the lost, as we give to people who are in need. So Tabitha may have been a provider for the widows that we will see live there in Joppa, looking out for their interest, taking care, organizing them. And she described as well as abounding in this ministry, continually doing this. It wasn't just something part-time. This was kind of her life. So as you went into the town of Joppa and you heard about this woman named Tabitha, if you were to ask anybody, well, what is she all about? What's she known for? They would say, well, kindness and charity. And that makes us think about our own ministry, our own lives. People were to come into your town, come into your community and say, well, what's so-and-so like? What's he involved with? What does she do with her time? What would people say about you? How would they describe you? How would you be known? And I know it's difficult to say, well, I don't know people in my community very well. They don't know me very well, so it might be kind of surface. But what if they came into the church and say, well, what's so-and-so like? What's he involved with? What does she do? You know that everybody would have an answer. The question just is, well, do I like the answer everybody would have? Is that something I want to be giving my life to so that they would say, oh yeah, he's into this. She spends her time doing this. And it's a good way to just to examine, how am I serving the Lord? What is my ministry? How has he gifted me? And am I doing it not in a way that's displaying myself publicly, but in a way that people know what it is because I'm doing it? You know, you don't want to keep your giftedness or your ministries hidden so nobody knows what you do or who you are. No, you're using your gifts for the benefit of the church. And when that's happening, look, everybody knows it. And they'd be able to say, oh, this is what she's involved with. This is how he spends his time. There's great significance in serving. And Tabitha is a reminder of that. So Tabitha is doing these things herself. We don't have too many of these organizations today, but you understand back in the previous century, early and middle part of the previous century, many churches had what they called a Dorcas Society. And these would be when the women of the church would gather together and they would make different items, they would do crafts, etc., for the purpose of selling them and then helping those who were in need. But Dorcas or Tabitha, she's described as doing this herself. She's functioning in this way. And we come to her need in verse 37. Look what it says there. And it happened at that time that she fell sick and died. It happened at that time. Definitely a man-centered perspective of what's going on. There's no coincidences in life. It just so happens that Peter's in the city, or nearby, and it just so happens that at this time, Tabitha becomes sick, and she dies. The end of verse 37, it says, when they had washed her body, they laid it in an upper room. This would have been done by the women, and this was in preparation for her burial. And the upper room is similar to what we read about earlier in the book of Acts. These were rooms that were directly under the roof, and they were often set apart as halls or meeting places for a particular house. Now, usually, when somebody died, they would bury the body immediately. In fact, the same day. But it seems that there may have been a different plan going on here. According to the book of Acts, no one had been raised from the dead in the early church so far. But these believers seem to have enough faith to ask for a miracle. They expected the Lord to do something. They expected the Lord to use Peter. Maybe they're thinking, this could be possible. And so what do? In verse 38, since Lydda was near Joppa, remember, Peter is in Lydda at this point, they know about it. The disciples, having heard that Peter was there, sent two men to him, imploring him, do not delay in coming to us. These are similar to the request of Jesus during his earthly ministry. When people would have those who are sick or those who are near dying, they would send requests to Jesus and say, come, we need your help right now. Now, it's possible that these disciples left to get Peter before Tabitha had died. That would be similar to the request for Jesus to come and work or heal Lazarus when he was sick. And as time went on, Lazarus actually died, and then Jesus arrived there and performed the miracle of bringing back Lazarus from the dead. Again, the timing is important here. They're in a rush to have all this done because, according to Jewish custom, the corpse had to be buried before sundown. And if you're thinking, well, putting this all together, perhaps Tabitha died in the morning, it'd be a 10-mile trip one way from Joppa to Lydda. It'd be about 3 or 4 hours on foot. And they get Peter, they rush him, and they come back, and they need to take care of all this before evening comes. Now we have the miracle. Verse 39. So Peter arose and went with them. When he arrived, they brought him into the upper room, and all the widows stood beside him, weeping and showing all the tunics and garments that Dorcas used to make while she was with them. Her dear friends are gathered there. They're weeping at the grief of death. And they begin showing Peter what a great woman Tabitha was, how she had made tunics and garments. These would be kind of coats or outer garments, and then the garments would be the clothing or the inner garments, as we think about how we dress today. This was regular. This was part of her habit. You see how it says the tunics and garments that she used to make. It's not that she did this once and then she just kept them hanging on a rack somewhere. This is what she did in an ongoing way, part of her kindness and her charity. What does Peter do? Look at verse 40. But Peter sent them all out. You can imagine some difficulty getting them all out of the upper room. And you wonder, why did Peter empty the room? Why did he want to be there just by himself with Tabitha? Well, with the body. You think back to what had happened in Samaria. And you remember how Simon the magician, got all enamored with the miracles and was completely led astray, thinking that this power was available through money, and if he paid enough money, he could have the Holy Spirit come on people as well. And Peter, remembering that, not wanting to make a big show of what was about to happen. You also think back to other examples of how God powerfully brought people back from the dead in biblical history. You think back to Jesus in Mark chapter 5 and how he gets everybody out of the room except just a small group of people. You go back to the Old Testament, to 1 and 2 Kings, Elijah and Elisha. And when a child dies, a different child in each one of their times of ministry, and they go into the room where the child's body is laying by themselves, and the room's empty, and the miracle occurs. So as God leads Peter to accomplish this task according to his perfect plan, Peter empties the room. And what does he do? Middle of verse 40, he knelt down and prayed. He's on his knees. He's asking God to do a miracle here. And it's important we understand that this is God's power, not Peter's power. Peter is simply a vessel, simply an instrument, simply a conduit. There's nothing that he's ever done in his life that allows him to do this. God has chosen him to do this, and he's just doing what he's doing. It's just as significant that Tabitha made clothing, fulfilling her ministry, as it is Peter praying for this body to come back to life. And the significance is not in the magnitude that's visible in the miracle. The significance is fulfilling what God has designed and called you to do. And that's exactly what Peter's doing here. So he kneels down, he prays, and then it says he turns to the body. It's almost as if he's separate from the body. The body's over in that part of the room, and he's over in this part of the room praying. He's avoiding all kinds of spectacle. There's no shouting going on. There's no histrionics, as we might call it, that people could say, wow, look what Peter did. He's simply on his knees praying. And then he turns to the body, and look what he says. So simple. Tabitha, arise. Again, following the Lord Jesus' example, again, Mark chapter 5, where he tells the child there to arise. And look what happens. And you wonder what's going on in Peter's heart right now. She opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up. God's power is continually functioning through creation. But this just doesn't happen every day, where a dead body opens its eyes and sits up. So she's back. Verse 41, and he gave her his hand and raised her up. The perfect gentleman sets out his hand, raises her up, and then verse 41 goes on and says, calling the saints and widows, he presented her alive. Everybody's back in the room now. This seems to be the normal procedure, if we can call raising someone from the dead normal, of how this occurs. The person, again, we go to Elijah or Elisha, we go to Jesus, and then once the miracle has occurred, there's a presentation back to the people, back to the family, back to the parent. Jesus gives the widow of Nain's son back to his mother after he raises him from the dead. So he presents her alive. What a joyful time for everybody there. They're just marveling. And what a joyful time, perhaps, for Tabitha. You know, she has already been in the presence of the Lord, and she's back. And so she joins that elite group. Lazarus is maybe the one who is the most elite because he was dead the longest before he comes back to life, but been into eternity and comes back and now has to go through the process of living life on earth again and then dying again later. But she's back. And you see the power of God at work here. Of course, if somebody is raised from the dead, that's power. But we have to make sure we understand this is not Peter. This is not the apostles' power. This is God's power through them. We know that because you can look in other parts of the New Testament and see, even when apostles were involved with people who were sick, healing didn't always occur. You have the Apostle Paul talking about Epaphroditus in Philippians chapter 2, and he describes it, Epaphroditus being sick, even to the point of death, but God heals him. Nowhere does it say, Paul talking about himself, and I heal them because I'm an apostle. It seems that the healing goes on in this man's life apart from the apostle. 1 Timothy 5:23, do you remember what Paul tells Timothy to do for his frequent ailments? He doesn't say, find an apostle and have him heal you. He says, take some wine. Your stomach's having problems, your frequent ailments, you need to do more than you're doing. And then 2 Timothy 4 and verse 20, the Apostle Paul says, he left Trophimus in Miletus sick. I mean, that would be awful. If you had the ability to heal somebody, you decide to leave them sick somewhere. No, this is God at work. This is God's power, and Peter is the conduit. Well, look again at the result. Beginning in verse 42, it became known all over Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. Again, what a story. I mean, it's a great story about Aeneas in Lydda, but now you've got Tabitha in Joppa, and she wasn't just in bed for 8 years, she was dead, and now she's alive again. More miracles, greater miracles, even though they're not given the space in the passage, but greater miracles are occurring when it says many believed than the details we have about Tabitha coming back to life from the dead. Verse 43, and Peter stayed many days in Joppa with a tanner named Simon. Luke uses this phrase often, many days. You remember we talked about this back in Acts chapter 9 and verse 23, just last week. There it says, when many days had elapsed. And we spoke there that many days covers, as we put together the different biographical details of the New Testament, many days covers about 3 years. So this could be 10 days, it could be 10 months, it could be several years. Many days he's there at Simon the tanner's house. Now, we're still talking about the result, and you don't want to miss the result in Peter's life as God is bringing him through this process. Notice that it doesn't say he stayed many days in Joppa with an accountant named Simon. Or a scientist named Simon, or an engineer named Simon, or a store clerk named Simon. This was Simon the tanner. Why is that significant? Well, those Jews who were rigorous in their religion would have viewed the occupation of Simon as unclean and avoided him completely. Why? Because a tanner required working with dead animals. What is a tanner? A tanner is somebody who strips the skin off of a dead animal and cures it. Not cures it like makes it alive again, but cures it like does a process to it so that it's useful. The skin can be used for different aspects of living life. So this tanner must necessarily involve himself in what was considered unclean. And so he would be shunned by the synagogue. One of the rabbis said, "It is impossible for the world to do without tanners, but woe to him who is a tanner." And even, this is interesting, a Jewish wife, if she discovered that her husband was a tanner, she was able to divorce him. Well, at this point in his life, Peter didn't have any of these prejudices. You see, God's working in his life. What we see just in this little detail here at the end of the chapter is a step on the road to further inclusion and interaction with the Gentiles. This little detail, even though it's subtle, it indicates clearly that there's a bend in the road, and it's coming. Peter is being prepared by God for what God has in store for him. And we see that as we move into Acts chapter 10. Next week, there will be a request for Peter to come and speak to a group of Gentiles. And during these many days that he's staying with Simon the tanner, God is preparing him to be ready for another display of his own power. Let's pray.